Chapter 9. Fruit of the Poisoned Tree. The act of judgment that leads scientists to reject a previously accepted theory is always based upon more than a comparison of that theory with the world. The decision to reject one paradigm is always simultaneously the decision to accept another, and the judgment leading to that decision involves the comparison of both paradigms with nature and with each other. Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. As we've seen, Leo Kanner liked to invoke the concept of serendipity, the notion that scientific discoveries result from the happy combination of accidents and sagacity. More to the point, he liked to say he was personally endowed with serendipity, what he called the gift of finding unsought treasures, citing his observation of the early cases of autism as a case in point. But Kanner's discovery was remarkable as much for what he failed to observe as for what he did. His mind was well prepared to draw a clear distinction between the children he examined and those described before him, and that part of his discovery has stood the test of time. But he did not possess the sagacity to ask obvious questions. Why had no one ever observed the pattern before him? What attributes did those early families really share that could explain the sudden arrival of this new condition? The combination of autism's rarity and Kanner's vanity made it possible for both him and others to credit his acute observational skills for the discovery. But as rising autism rates brought the tragedy home to increasing numbers of families, true serendipity would soon have to benefit from the greater sagacity of fresh observers. Within a short period during the 1990s, three different observers launched the search for a new environmental paradigm based on two separate causation theories. Both theories involved infant vaccines, a hot-button area that would soon mire the autism community in new controversies. But none of these three began their autism journey with a particular bias against vaccination. Instead, they all had prior experiences that simply prepared them to offer a risky theory. The father of germ theory, Louis Pasteur, famously remarked that, where observation is concerned, chance favors only the prepared mind. So far, we've focused on the roots of only the autism-mercury theory. For the other theory, however, the causal roots came from a surprising direction. Real insight into the causes of autism would require observing not just the brain, but also the bowel. Frankenstein's monster evolves. Rosemary Kesick, or Rose, was prepared for autism in ways few parents are. Her parents, Glover and Dorothy Lunn, were both medical professionals. Her father, first a scientist and then a medical doctor in England's National Health Service, did early research on nutrition. Her mother, a nurse who worked alongside her father in their general medical practice, raised three children while juggling a career translating medical jargon into practical patient advice. One of those children posed a special challenge to the family. Rose's older brother, David, was schizophrenic, struck with the disease in adolescence when Rose was just 6 years old. Like many family members affected by mental illness, Rose was forced to survive schizophrenia, along with her parents and brothers. Her parents didn't survive very long. Glover Lunn died at 52 when Rose was just 11. Dorothy died 10 years later at the age of 53. Rose notes with pride that her parents' former patients still come up to her on the street and tell her how much they appreciated the care her parents provided. Rose sees this as a product of her parents' strong values. They always treated their patients with respect, had a healthy skepticism of commercial medicine, and worked incredibly hard. Rose's pride comes with battle scars. Back when she was growing up, parents of schizophrenics, like autism parents, had a tough time. Freudian theorists also blamed schizophrenia on bad parenting. Although her parents never bought the Freudian line, Rose remembers her father telling her schizophrenia was clearly biological. There was little they could do about the prejudices of others. When her own children were born, her oldest son James in 1981 and her second son William in 1988, Rose followed in her mother's footsteps. She juggled raising children with a career, starting as a college lecturer in communications and drama, and then going into business. Making the transition back to work had gone smoothly with James, and so she was optimistic for a similar transition with William. Always lurking in the back of Rose's mind, however, was a fear for her own family's survival. "I always had a real terror that my children would be schizophrenic," she recalls. So she had a vivid memory, when she was pregnant with William, of hearing a radio report claiming that English scientists had discovered the cause of schizophrenia. It was a gene, of course. Rose approached her doctors to see if she could test for the gene. They told her that, well, the claim reported on the radio was a bit premature, the gene didn't really explain much after all, and there were no tests. Nonetheless, Rose and her doctors did scrutinize William's early development closely. Everyone assured her there's absolutely nothing wrong with this baby, and everything Rose saw with her own eyes led her to believe them. In fact, William seemed to be ahead of typical infants in many ways. Rose remembers him as clear and focused within hours of birth. After leaving the hospital, he hit all his early developmental milestones on or ahead of schedule. Even beyond those things pediatricians measure formally, William was the sort of baby that gives parents great joy. He was physically affectionate and cuddly. He gleefully played peekaboo games, extending the interactions with delight. He pointed and made eye contact. He understood language clearly, and he had developing vocabulary of his own. Words like drink, book, call, James, and cat, a special favorite. All that changed at 15 months. Within days of receiving his MMR vaccine, William became a different child. Almost immediately he began having digestive problems, more bowel movements each day, and these with unusual colors and smells. Also, immediately, his sleep patterns changed. A child who used to wake up just once a night became a fitful sleeper. The slightest noise awoke him, and he almost never settled for a period of extended sleep. Most of all, Rose remembers that he just never looked right, as though he was simply sick all the time. Before long, William began banging his head and presenting with symptoms of autism, losing all his language and social connection. Rose found it nearly impossible to get help for William's mysterious set of symptoms. Most medical doctors had never heard of autism, and those who had some dim awareness insisted that William was not autistic. "I can tell you absolutely he's not autistic," one said. "William needs speech therapy." They were even more flummoxed by the link between his brain and gut problem. Not one doctor could look at William and say, "I've seen this pattern before," said Rose. Not a one. When Rose mentioned her suspicion over the connection between the MMR vaccine and William's downward spiral, the conversation closed down almost immediately. "Don't worry your pretty head about MMR," one specialist told her. The possibility of an adverse vaccine reaction wasn't even worth considering. "I've seen vaccine damage before," said another. "This is not a vaccine reaction." About this time, Rose's local pediatrician commented to her, "You know, this is funny. I'm seeing quite a few local children that are presenting a bit like William. You should all get together." As Rose met these families, it became obvious to her that many of these children were similar to William in having both developmental and digestive issues. None of the other children were quite as severe as William, but the same symptom pattern jumped out at her, even when the parents were in denial. Out of necessity, Rose began to put the pieces of the puzzle together on her own. She started wondering about William's diet. Perhaps something he was eating was causing the diarrhea. So she went through an exercise of rotating individual foods out of his diet, one by one. This process of elimination yielded two clear culprits, milk and wheat. When she removed just these foods from William's diet, his sleep and behavior improved noticeably, although not his diarrhea. So when William was three, she put him on a diet free of wheat and dairy products. And it worked. Not as a cure, but rather as a clear continuation of the results she had seen in her little experiment. It was the first intervention Rose had ever found for William that made a difference, and the experience marked an emotional turning point. She realized that no doctor was going to give her the answers about William. She was going to have to figure things out for herself. William's initial diagnosis was not autism. He wouldn't get a formal autism diagnosis until later. But rather, receptive dysphagia, a speech disorder. So Rose began looking for the best speech program she could find, and soon pinpointed the best in the country. An initial 3-day assessment went well, and a few months later, William went back to start the program. Then her phone rang. "This is not the same child we assessed," the school told her. No longer simply nonverbal and not sleeping, William was now throwing tantrums and screaming nonstop. "You'll probably need to institutionalize him for life," the speech teachers told her. "This child is seriously damaged." After months of progress, William had crashed again, this time more violently than after his MMR vaccination, and for no discernible reason. Rose felt she had little choice but to redouble her efforts on the biological treatment front. Intrigued by William's progress from a simple elimination diet, she wondered if his recent crash might have to do with something that was now missing from his diet. Perhaps he had some kind of vitamin deficiency. Not knowing how to connect specific vitamins and symptoms, Rose set out to find a reference book that could help her diagnose a vitamin problem. She called every vitamin and pharmaceutical company she could track down, and before long, she found something. Stored back in the shelves of a veterinary medicine department was a little red book titled Vitamin Compendium, The Properties of the Vitamins and Their Importance in Human and Animal Nutrition. Published in 1976 by the Vitamins and Chemicals Department of Hoffman LaRoche, the chapters of the book went through the symptoms of individual vitamin deficiency, often using animal models to spell out the symptoms of each. When she saw a picture of an unhappy little pig that was deficient in vitamin B12, Rose felt as though she was looking at an animal model of William. So she began a new search for vitamin B12 treatment. Before long, she had begun B12 injections and found a specialized vitamin B12 unit where she entered William into an intensive program of daily injections for 2 weeks. Sure enough, Rose's intuition appeared right again. After the injections, William's behavior improved. The crisis that had come on so suddenly was gone just as fast. Still, the diarrhea remained. Encouraged by her second success, Rose next turned her attention to the underlying condition of William's gut. She had long been interested in the gut flora, the natural bacteria that line all of our intestinal walls. So her ears perked up when she heard of a nearby clinical trial that targeted the gut flora. Some local doctors were giving probiotics to patients with Crohn's disease, a form of inflammatory bowel disease. Rose knew almost nothing about Crohn's disease, but she contacted the investigators who were conducting the trial anyway. Displaying her formidable powers of persuasion, Rose obtained a course of the experimental treatment and was delighted to see yet another puzzle piece fall into place. No more diarrhea. After taking the special formulation, William had consistent, solid stools for the first time in his life. Following this string of discoveries, wheat and milk reaction, vitamin B12 deficiency, gut flora problems, Rose felt encouraged and frustrated at the same time. It seemed she was collecting pieces of the puzzle without connecting any of them to the triggering event. Try as she might, Rose couldn't come up with a theory for a mechanism that could connect William's MMR vaccination with his bowel disease and autism symptoms. In May 1995, she picked up the phone and called Jackie Fletcher at Justice Awareness and Basic Support, JABS, England's leading vaccine safety group. Rose's interest in bowel disease diverged from most of Fletcher's work at JABS, which focused on brain injury from vaccines. But it sparked a thought. Fletcher, who closely followed the scientific literature on vaccine viruses, told her there was a doctor at the Royal Free Hospital who had just published some interesting work on the measles virus and Crohn's disease in Scandinavia. "He might be open to your ideas on this," Fletcher told Rose. The conversation with Fletcher inspired Rose. For the first time, she could trace a direct line between bowel disease and the Crohn's disease trial and measles virus from the MMR vaccine. Was this the missing piece in the puzzle that could explain William's reaction to the MMR? She hung up the phone with Jackie and called Directory Inquiries for the number of the Royal Free Hospital. Reaching the switchboard, she asked for the researcher's direct line, and they put her through. The researcher picked up his own phone.
"Hello, my name is Rosemary Kessick," she began, "and I'm not mad."
The Scandinavian study that Jackie Fletcher described to Rose Kessick, one that was soon to launch the biggest medical controversy in autism since Bettelheim, actually had nothing to do with either vaccines or autism. Rather, it was an investigation of the possible role of measles infection in a particular form of inflammatory bowel disease. The connections would prove to run deeper than even Rose expected in her moment of discovery. Crohn's disease is yet another of the new diseases of the industrialized world, although in the case of Crohn's, its novelty, late emergence, and rapid rise are more generally accepted. Like other diseases we've described, some of the earliest signs of Crohn's disease emerged in Great Britain. A Glasgow surgeon named Thomas Dalziel was among the first to describe a case series in 1913. But by now the disease had spread all over the world. Scattered cases were characterized in the 19th century, but the first comprehensive description came from a New York doctor named Burrell Crone and two colleagues in 1932, who first described a disease of the terminal ileum, affecting mainly young adults. The disease is clinically featured by symptoms that resemble those of ulcerative colitis, namely fever, diarrhea, and emaciation, leading eventually to the obstruction of the small intestine. They called their disease regional ileitis, but due to Burrell Crone's subsequent efforts to promote awareness of the disease, the condition eventually bore his name. Crone's observations were centered on some striking and visible symptoms in the terminal ileum, the last segment of the small intestine, before it feeds into the large intestine and colon. Later, the inflammatory profile of Crohn's disease would be found beyond the terminal ileum, but this was at least in part because of the evolution of the disease, not an error in Crohn's observations. For these first patients described in 1932, the florid and painful inflammation in the tail end of the small intestine was no mere inconvenience. Crohn's disease was always an agonizing experience for its sufferers, and sometimes fatal. Unlike autism and schizophrenia, there was little disagreement among specialists that Crohn's was new, nor was there much difficulty in concluding that its growth rate was explosive. Over two decades later, Crone looked back on his 1932 article and wrote, "From this small beginning, we have witnessed the evolution of a Frankenstein monster that, if not threatening to life, frequently results in serious illness, often prolonged and debilitating. And in the half-century since Crone first invoked the classic specter of cinematic horror, this monster has continued to grow, evolve, and raise difficult new questions." 40 years after Crone's own retrospective, leading authorities on Crohn's disease continue to emphasize the obvious. Some change in the environment must be involved in the rise of this intestinal scourge.
Even more disturbing to some observers has been the rise of Crohn's disease in children, a rise that was noted with special urgency in Great Britain. One study found a threefold rise in Scottish children in a 15-year period. The study authors treated these increases seriously and took pains to emphasize that this increase was a real one and couldn't be explained by changes in diagnostic criteria or other changes in diagnostic patterns. Inevitably, the rising pediatric caseload called forth a new supply of specialists to treat the affected children. Pediatric gastroenterology had been practically unheard of as a practice, yet this rise in pediatric Crohn's cases helped to recruit a new cadre of both clinical and research talent to the field. An Australian gastroenterologist named John Walker Smith became one of the main referring physicians in the United Kingdom. Starting in the 1970s, children with Crohn's disease throughout England, Scotland, and Wales were referred to his clinic at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, where he became the world's leading expert on pediatric Crohn's. He wrote the seminal textbook, Diseases of the Small Intestine in Childhood, in 1974. By 1999, as the textbook went into its fourth edition, and joined this time by a younger co-author named Simon Murch, he commented at some length on the continued rise of childhood Crohn's disease and the likely role of new environmental factors. We can hear the echoes of Kreplin's global surveys of GPI in his sobering analysis. The geographical distribution of Crohn's disease is of interest, as it appears to be more prevalent in Northwest Europe and America, suggesting a factor related to Western societies and, more specifically, urbanized areas. It is found in African-American, but rarely in African children. In the author's UK practice, the incidence of Crohn's disease in Afro-Caribbean children increased in a decade from a notable rarity to commonplace. More remarkable increases in children of Indian subcontinent origin are also now being seen with Crohn's disease, whereas the disease remains very uncommon in children in the subcontinent itself. He concluded, "The appearance of the disease in children of immigrants, together with the increases in incidence of Crohn's disease in general in Western societies, suggests that an environmental agent or agents may be important in the pathogenesis of Crohn's disease." Not surprisingly, getting to the bottom of the Crohn's disease epidemic in both adults and children was a hot topic for research gastroenterologists. By the mid-1990s, when Jackie Fletcher spoke to Rose, there were a number of theories in circulation, with quite a lot of interest centering on infection as the unknown environmental factor. The specific pattern of the Crohn's disease inflammation led many to suspect that a microbe was involved, either a viral or bacterial infection. Starting around 1990, two research groups began to focus on the connection between Crohn's disease and measles. One of them, the Inflammatory Bowel Disease, IBD, study group, based at the Royal Free Hospital in London, started out by taking a fresh look at the bowel tissue itself, and especially the terminal ileum, employing a host of innovative new methods and technologies. In 1993, the IBD study group set out to look specifically for measles DNA and made a surprising discovery. In almost every case of Crohn's tissue they examined, genetic testing showed the presence of measles virus. The same testing showed the virus in only a minority of the controls. They became intrigued by the idea that Crohn's disease might be caused, or at least promoted, by a persistent measles infection. Meanwhile, another group from Sweden, the Cancer Epidemiology Unit of University Hospital in Uppsala, came at the measles issue from a different perspective, by looking for evidence at the population level. Data from a comprehensive sample of Swedish Crohn's cases, 93 in all, showed a high rate of early life infection, either prenatal in the mother or postnatal in the child. Out of 18 identifiable infections, Measles was part of the picture in two of the patient's mothers, both of whom, the Swedish investigators learned, were infected in the last weeks of their pregnancy. So in 1993, representatives from these two groups, including the head of the IBD study group and the head of the Swedish team, got together to perform a series of studies focusing on measles infections in the population that included the Swedish Crohn's cases. They first found an elevated risk of Crohn's due to measles exposure. But only when the measles infection came within weeks of the birth date. This, interestingly enough, was the Scandinavian study from the Royal Free that Jackie Fletcher mentioned to Rose Kesick. Next, they decided to seek out and investigate each individual case of maternal measles infection they could find in a large population where the infection took place during pregnancy. What they found amazed them. Out of 25,000 babies delivered in Uppsala's University Hospital between 1940 and 1949, there were only four known cases where the mother had measles during pregnancy, two of whom had surfaced in the earlier study of known Crohn's cases. Following up on each of these cases, researchers found that three out of the four children went on to develop Crohn's disease. Although this study is biased by the selection of a period when it was known that two cases of measles in the mother were followed by Crohn's disease in the offspring, the authors commented, "The detection of a third such case in the only four mothers to have had measles during pregnancy is extraordinary." This observation didn't appear to be universal, since population surveys of measles epidemics in the United Kingdom didn't show the same result. Still, both the Swedish and the British teams kept at it and produced a continuing series of papers. One of these was titled, "Is Measles Vaccination a Risk Factor for Inflammatory Bowel Disease?" and followed up one of the original clinical trial groups for the measles vaccine administered in 1964 in the United Kingdom. They found that the vaccinated group had three times the risk of developing Crohn's than unvaccinated controls. The lead Swedish researcher was well rewarded for his work. In 1999, Anders Ekbom was appointed full professor of epidemiology at Sweden's prestigious Karolinska Institutet. The leader of the Royal Free's IBD study group, a young British researcher named Andrew Wakefield, had a different path ahead of him. Paradigms Wars. Despite the inescapable rise in autism rates, most medical scientists have tried their best to escape its implications. It may not sound very scientific, but even for scientists, abandoning comfortable beliefs for an inconvenient truth is often painful business. Still, their resulting resistance has created extra hurdles for those who make the obvious case for the role of the environment in autism. It's not enough merely to demonstrate that what we thought we knew about autism was wrong. The scientific community has insisted on something nearly impossible to provide, a more satisfying and appealing explanation of what kind of disease model is at work. In other words, both a superior and more comfortable replacement theory. Unfortunately, the search for that explanation has put not just theory and evidence, but also politics into play. In part one, we described quite a number of different archetypes for environmental diseases, each one of which has the potential to inform new theories of autism, none of them convenient or comfortable. Could autism be a simple case of undiagnosed mercury poisoning, like hysteria? Does it have its origins in well-meaning but dangerous medical treatments that produce a unique model of developmental mercury poisoning, like acrodynia? Is it instead a new and specific, if easy to miss, interaction between toxic metals and a single microbe, like GPI? Or is the situation worse than that, with autism an elusive disease of industrial civilization, like schizophrenia, one that risks being passed over indefinitely as just a basic part of the human condition? Resolving these questions is more urgent than ever, because a full-fledged paradigm war has broken out, and with it, a race for the intellectual high ground on causation. Regardless of whether one accepts that autism rates have increased or not, its new prominence has raised indisputable interest in tracing its causes. There's no shortage of causal theories either. Just about everyone agrees that there is a seed that grows into a poisoned tree, and each theory brings with it a medical model for how best to avoid bearing more fruit from the poisoned tree. Beyond that, any semblance of common ground vanishes. In numerous ways, it's hard to imagine a more deeply antagonistic battle between the medical industry on one hand and health consumers on the other, with the disciplines of science and the individual career prospects of scientists caught in the middle. At their core, the paradigms most readily embraced by the medical industry have placed a defective seed somewhere in the heart of the family. Channeling Freud, Bettelheim blamed homicidal mothers. Rejecting Freud, biological determinists then turned to inherited genes, and the heritability theory swept the scientific community. This new turn managed to shift the blame, albeit not very far, from bad parenting to genetically unfit parents, from homicidal mothers to defective children. But at their core, these prevailing paradigms have offered little in the way of hope for the families of affected children, especially the heritability theory. The target of much recent research has been finding the autism genes, but that research begs a crucial question. What happens if and when you find the genes? The most obvious opportunities would then come before conception and birth, discovering genetic problems in high-risk pairings and their progeny. In this guise, the therapy for autism prevention is unspoken but clear. Abortion. To be sure, the research program of the genetics camp is targeted at a model of action in the longer run. By specifying clusters of genes, these scientists point out new insights might emerge on metabolic pathways that have gone awry. Understanding these faulty pathways may eventually lead to new therapies, new psychotropic drugs for autistic people, and perhaps more sophisticated preventative measures for pregnant and susceptible autism moms. Realistically, however, any such treatments are decades away at best. Unlike the impact of penicillin on syphilis, the genetic discovery model as a path to effective therapy may be an appealing prospect, but it has more to offer as a marketing tool than in achieving realistic results in the here and now. In terms of getting down to the core of the problem quickly, it's largely an evasion tactic. By contrast, the model that Rose Kesick set in motion in both form and substance places the toxic seed squarely outside the family. Instead of defective children, the new model argues that the affected children would otherwise have been normal, but instead became chronically ill. Not only that, but largely ill, served by a medical industry increasingly constrained by the cookbooks of reimbursement-based care. The new model has found its most powerful resources in an unorthodox place, with professional parents taking on a new prominence as both clinicians and citizen scientists. Like the genetic model, this revolutionary theory is biological in focus, but by placing the prospect of medical and manufacturing malpractice squarely on the table, this new model has made some powerful enemies. Unlikely revolutionaries. On May 17, 1995, Andrew Wakefield picked up the phone in his small, windowless office at the Royal Free Hospital. Rosemary Kesick was on the line, calling him about her 7-year-old autistic son, William. Wakefield was impressed by Rose. She was intelligent, articulate, and unemotional, as she described William's case history in painstaking detail. She had clearly done her homework. Her ideas on elimination diets, and especially on vitamin B12 deficiency, sounded reasonable to him. If William had some early onset form of Crohn's disease, it would make sense that he wasn't getting enough B12. The terminal ileum was the place in the bowel where B12 was mostly absorbed. Like others along Rose's journey, Wakefield was impressed not just by her logic, but by her determination. Rose was not the sort of person to let you off the hook easily. She asked him for his advice, which was easy enough. But more to the point, she asked him for his help. As a medical doctor, he remembers his first reaction. Why hadn't anyone investigated William's obvious gastrointestinal distress? As a research gastroenterologist, faced with a condition he had never heard of before, a rare bowel condition, possibly an early-onset form of Crohn's disease, coupled with autistic symptoms, he was also intrigued. He knew from experience that unusual cases like William's often provided the greatest opportunity for original insight. So he agreed to help. Before that fatal telephone call with Rose, Wakefield's medical research career had been marked by a steady stream of success and accomplishment. Following his medical education, he received a prestigious research scholarship as a Wellcome Research Fellow. He spent the first year of his grant working with leading experts in small bowel transplantation at the University of Toronto, and then moved back to England to continue his fellowship, joining the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Group at the Royal Free Hospital. Wakefield fast became a rising star within the Royal Free. He was named senior lecturer in 1993, skipping a step in the academic hierarchy, promoted to reader in 1997, and soon launched a dynamic new group within the Royal Free, the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Study Group. The IBD Study Group represented the spirit of what is called, in modern medical jargon, translational medicine. The basic idea of translational medicine is to promote close collaboration between research and clinical practice so that insights from the bedside are reflected in research projects, therefore making the bench, or the lab, more relevant to real medical problems. Comprised of a cross-disciplinary group of clinical researchers and skilled clinicians, the IBD study group met weekly to discuss interesting patients, new research ideas, treatment outcomes, surgical procedures, and the medical writing they could do to disseminate their insights. Papers from the IBD study group were published in some of the leading journals in medicine. Collegial and collaborative, innovative and ambitious, it was a high-performance team that was just the sort to take on challenges of the type William Keswick posed. But before long, Wakefield, and also his colleagues in the IBD study group, John Walker Smith and Simon Murch, confronted a series of choices that would forever change the course of autism research and their careers. Rose Keswick's telephone call presented the first fateful choice, one that seemed quite obvious at the time. Wakefield had little difficulty in deciding to help William Keswick. Better yet, he knew just the doctor to refer her to, John Walker Smith. Not only was Walker Smith the author of the standard textbook on childhood bowel disease, he was at that moment bringing his pediatric gastroenterology practice over to the Royal Free and joining the IBD study group. On Wakefield's suggestion, Walker Smith saw Rose and William, just a couple of months after her initial contact with Wakefield. Before long, in part through Rose's network, several other parents had called Wakefield looking for help with their children. Walker Smith began meeting with these families as well, and the emergence of an apparent cluster of highly similar children reinforced Wakefield's original intuition that William might be an important case. As the number of referrals started to expand, there were fewer than 10 at the outset, but over several months the number rose to a dozen. Wakefield and Walker Smith found themselves faced with a second choice. Should they investigate the group of children to confirm a pattern? all of the children presented essentially the same profile. Autism, 10 of 12, 2 with encephalitis, with clear regression within days after vaccination with MMR. 10 of 12, one after measles infection, another after an ear infection. Alongside bowel symptoms, all 12. For Wakefield and Walker Smith, both committed to the model of translational medicine, this seemed to be another easy choice. Not only was it ethical to investigate whether these children shared a novel disease process, it was their obligation. So as Walker Smith continued his initial consultations with the families, the IBD study group began pursuing two related but distinct investigative tracks. They began scoping out a proposal for a full-scale research project, one involving a careful study of cases and controls, though they knew that gold-standard research proposals like this took a long time to design correctly and required rigorous ethical approvals. The time required to obtain funding and approval would delay clinical work with the children and the consistency of any subsequent treatments, so they felt the need to investigate the basic patterns in this group faster than the basic research plan would allow. For clinical and treatment purposes, therefore, they moved ahead on a second, more expeditious track. They laid out a testing schedule over the subsequent 6 months for all 12 children, including simple colonoscopies and urine collections to test for a marker of vitamin B12 deficiency. Scheduling colonoscopies quickly had a side benefit. It created the opportunity to do some rudimentary research. As part of his agreement to bring his practice to the Royal Free, Walker Smith had a standing approval from the Ethical Practices Committee to use biopsy and other tissue samples collected during his clinical work for research purposes. Case series of this size, although not adequate for a gold standard research design, frequently serve as the earliest evidence of a new form of disease, and the initial report of the pattern can often represent a lasting contribution to medicine. After all, Leo Kanner's first report on autism in 1943 had 11 cases, and Burrell Crohn's landmark 1932 paper on Crohn's disease had 14. As the schedule turned out, although William was supposed to go first in July 1996, his procedure was delayed until after the August holiday, while another child went first. Like David Speck in Kanner's referral sequence, this first case in July provided interesting results, while also deferring the investigator's moment of true discovery. The first child showed definite evidence of bowel inflammation, technically chronic nonspecific colitis, and acute cecal cryptitis, but no clear sign of Crohn's disease symptoms, largely because the first colonoscopy procedure was the least successful of the 12. Simon Murch, Walker Smith's younger colleague who performed the colonoscopies, wasn't able to reach and observe the terminal ileum. William went second in September 1996, and in his case, Murch was able to obtain more definitive results. William had the same colitis as the first child, but upon entering the terminal ileum, Murch saw evidence of a far more dramatic kind, a striking pattern of swollen and inflamed lymph nodes, or lymphoid nodular hyperplasia, LNH, in medical jargon. Wakefield calls William the sentinel child, and as the remaining 10 children completed their procedures over the next 4 months, the LNH pattern observed in William held up repeatedly. Not just that, but the vitamin B12 markers came back, confirming signs of abnormalities in all of the children. There was a real sense of excitement in the IBD study group. First of all, their preliminary investigation showed clearly that the parents were right. Despite widespread resistance to their concerns, their children did indeed have bowel disease, just as they claimed. Second, and more important, Walker Smith could help these children immediately by treating them for bowel inflammation. the standard treatment, a bowel medication called mesalazine, met with quick positive results in all of the children, especially for William. But the benefits of the case series approach made the findings even better than that. Not only could the IBD study group help these 12 children, the consistency in the findings suggested they might help many more. The team agreed quickly to write up the results as an early report and submit it to The Lancet, where it was accepted promptly and published a year later in February 1998. In the meantime, the IBD study group also agreed that the more comprehensive project proposal deserved the highest priority. But since this project was considerably larger than a simple clinical case series, it would require resources, patience, and more extensive sampling. The larger size and scope of the second project presented a third choice for the group, one with both financial and, for Wakefield, legal ramifications. As Rose and the other parents were organizing to get their children bowel examinations and treatments, they also started to organize to get compensated through the established British government program for vaccine injury. They all believed the MMR triggered their children's autism, and since the future financial burden on these families in caring for their autistic children would be enormous, it was only natural that they take their case to the Legal Aid Board, LAB, the approved channel for taking vaccine injury claims to the government. So as the research agenda took shape during 1996 and 1997, the economic distress and financial interests of the parents became intertwined with the IBD study group's research. For Wakefield and his colleagues, this series of developments clarified their third choice. Should they take money from the parents' lawyers to sponsor the work they had planned and permit their research to be connected to a legal process? The question here came down not to a funding question for the IBD study group, which had little to gain financially, but to a simple moral choice. Wakefield recalls that his moment of decision came when the mother of one of the 12 children verbalized a thought that many autism parents have shared, and an unfortunate few parents have acted on. "Please don't judge me too harshly," she stated in an apologetic tone. "But when I go, I will be taking my son with me." Realizing the scale of the human problem facing these families, Wakefield didn't hesitate, and as head of the IBD study group, made a decision to accept funding from the Legal Aid Board. This came in two forms. The Royal Free Hospital accepted £55,000, just under $100,000, for the second study, but not the case series published in The Lancet. As research grants go, it was a modest amount, and although much of the research work was eventually done, it was never published, due to all the subsequent controversy. Of greater potential concern, due to the remuneration involved, Wakefield also agreed to serve as an expert witness for the parents, working for the standard hourly rate for experts of £150. About $270, over a period of 8 years, most of it subsequent to the Lancet publication. He received over £300,000, over $500,000, in fees, or £180,000 after taxes. Although modest on an annual basis, that's a material amount of financial support, and it's appropriate to ask the question, what did Wakefield do with the money? For all practical purposes, he donated it back to the hospital. More precisely, Wakefield used the LAB proceeds in an attempt to build intellectual capital for the practice of gastroenterology at the Royal Free. In June 1997, Wakefield filed a patent application on a treatment for persistent measles infections. Most academic research institutions encourage their researchers to file patents on their medical innovations. No exception to this pattern, the Royal Free has filed close to 20 patent applications since 1986. He had developed an idea about a treatment and hoped the patent would help commercialize the invention while also generating funds for a new gastroenterology center for the Royal Free. Over half of the net proceeds from his expert services went into patent filing fees. The rest funded administrative support for the autism project. Looking back, any objective observer would conclude that the project was a clear financial failure. The treatment patent was never granted. No clinical trials were attempted. The investment capital was lost, and the hospital, and for that matter Wakefield himself, spent every penny it received with little subsequent benefit. But from a public relations standpoint, this donation to the hospital was a catastrophe. These LAB payments spelled career disaster for the young researcher, and soon became a media snowball. In the hands of a British journalist named Brian Deer, these payments were eventually skewed to make Wakefield look financially motivated and ethically compromised. How this happened requires a framework, which takes us back to the concept of paradigm wars that inevitably occur during periods of revolutionary science. Scientific revolutions require revolutionaries. It's not a fun job. As scientists from Galileo Galilei to Ignaz Semmelweis have demonstrated. And for better or worse, Andrew Wakefield has taken on the mantle of revolutionary scientist in autism. This occurred not because he sought out the role, but simply because he had the courage to do the right thing when faced with a series of moral choices. And unlike any other research scientist in recent memory, Andrew Wakefield has been singled out by the medical industry, not just for sanctions, but for public excoriation. In part, based on a letter filed by Brian Deer with the General Medical Council, GMC, Wakefield, Walker Smith, and Murch were placed on trial before the GMC. The GMC hearings, which went on for more than 150 days over a period of more than 2 years, attempted the remarkable feat of turning the clinical and research choices of these men into a sinister narrative of conspiracy and bad medicine. The doctors' straightforward choices surrounding clinical care, research design, funding, and expert witness support were all woven into this narrative, and the length of the proceeding provided evidence, if nothing else, of the difficulty of making the alternative narrative plausible. The prosecution's case started out with these experts' choices regarding clinical care and argued that if these 12 Lancet children had autism, then by definition there was no other medical condition of any relevance whatsoever. Thus, according to the GMC, administering a procedure such as a colonoscopy, by definition, was unethical. Never mind whether a leading specialist like John Walker Smith investigated the clinical symptoms of children with bowel disease all the time. These children were just autistic, and therefore couldn't have it. It didn't matter if they had clear symptoms of bowel disease, diarrhea, or constipation, or both. The prosecution argued there was no ethical justification for performing a colonoscopy on autistic children, even if Walker Smith had all the necessary clinical authority, and even if the parents gave informed consent. The second prong of the prosecution's case effectively rejected the innovative premise of translational medicine and argued instead that clinical medicine must be performed according to standard practice, and all research must be performed at the greatest possible distance from active clinical practice. It matters not that the published research at issue in the Lancet study was secondary to clinical care. The fact that a case series was written up and published in a research journal demonstrates that the three doctors were performing unethical experiments on children. This argument rests on outdated suppositions, that research can only be conducted at a complete remove from the patients, that autism is fully understood as a brain disorder, that there is no urgency for treatment, and that the IBD study group should never have pursued the research question to begin with. Finally, the prosecution's case cut to the heart of the question, the money, and turned the tables on the question of financial motivation. They claimed it wasn't the companies and the healthcare providers who had the profit interest here. It was the patients. Since the MMR vaccine was the hypothesized exposure based on parental observation, it was not acceptable to investigate the legitimate question posed by the parents. More to the point, to permit a rigorous scientific investigation funded by legal counsel to financially interested parties to proceed was, according to the prosecution, malpractice by definition. And it wasn't just the parents' greed that was suspect. It was Wakefield's patent application that was the driving motivation, according to the narrative of the media. He wanted to invent a commercial product to replace the MMR. "He did it for the money," went the accusation. "He was just trying to get rich from his patent." But all 12 children got excellent care from one of the best specialists in the world. Their parents were delighted with the services they received and never complained. Indeed, parents of 8 of the 12 protested actively and publicly against the GMC proceeding. The finding of a novel bowel condition has been consistently replicated, although the subsequent finding of the persistence of the measles virus itself has been questioned. As for the legal process, the LAB work for the parents on MMR was simply shut down by the British government, which has full power over the resources available to plaintiffs' counsel, a short 4 months before the case was to go to trial. In the meantime, a single journalist, the only man in the world ever known to have complained to the GMC about Wakefield, managed to generate the longest trial proceeding in GMC history. Along the way, Wakefield lost his position at the Royal Free, his sure path to a professorship, and all hope for a mainstream career. In February 2010, the GMC ruled against Wakefield and his colleagues, an unsurprising, though deeply unjustified finding, and in May 2010, as this book was in press, revoked his and Walker Smith's licenses to practice medicine. The Lancet fully retracted the 1998 study. Another journal, Neurotoxicology, owned by the same publisher, withdrew a separate crucial study on the impact of the U.S. infant vaccination schedule on primates, a study that had been peer-reviewed, accepted by its editor, and published online, citing Wakefield's involvement. And Wakefield resigned from his position at Thoughtful House, the Texas Treatment and Research Center he founded after leaving London. His powerful opponents may believe they have scrubbed the record clean of the work of an inconvenient scientist, but they have managed to galvanize a number of powerful autism groups behind him in an effort to enable his work to continue. Revolutionaries are always vulnerable to attack. But in the modern world where religion has largely separated from science, taking a heretical position on a controversial scientific theory is not usually grounds for excommunication. But Wakefield's actions touched two deep chords. For one, he put vaccine adverse events front and center as a possible cause of autism, a large and growing problem. Second, he confronted the anomaly of the autism epidemic and the obvious role of environmental factors. In the process, he turned the theory of autism quite literally upside down, from the brain to the bowels. Sally Bernard's first revolutionary impulse came from a simpler source. In her case, it was little more than a natural parent's reflex. In early 1993, she heard about a new paper that Ivar Lovaas, a prominent autism theorist, had published that followed up on a group he first treated in 1987. In his latest paper, Lovaas made some startling claims. His treatment had not merely helped the original study group. He argued that 8 of 9 of them had made dramatic gains after undergoing a rigorous program of behavioral modification. According to Lovaas, the children he had treated were indistinguishable from average children on tests of intelligence and adaptive behavior. In other words, they had recovered from autism. The idea of recovery focused Bernard's attention. Up to that moment, she had heard little from her doctors that wasn't depressing. Recovery was serious business, and if this was real, Bernard would have to change everything she was doing. She needed to know how credible this study was to filter out the spin. There was only one way to do this. She simply had to read the full text of the article herself. There were not many parents in 1993 that would seek out and read the full text of a scientific paper themselves. This was before technology made medical information widely available to anyone with an internet connection and a credit card. The lay public were almost always forced to get scientific information through filters and virtually never read the full text of a paper. This created numerous practical obstacles when it came to learning about medical science. In order to interpret scientific texts, the reader had to possess access to medical libraries and to go through a structured degree program, MD or PhD, for example. Without access to either of these privileges, health consumers were widely considered to be incapable of making independent judgments on scientific issues. But Sally Bernard was not your typical member of the lay public. A graduate of Harvard, where she majored in history and graduated with honors, she had gone into the field of market research. Like Rose Kesick, Sally Bernard entered the world of autism well into a career that had given her considerable training in assimilating and mastering technical concepts and jargon. Also like Rose Kesick, Bernard chose to juggle children and motherhood alongside a demanding career and gave birth to triplets in 1987. The first two of the three developed normally, but her third son, Bill, had troubles from the beginning. He was the smallest of the three at birth, weighing in at barely 3 pounds, and frequently sick. At every stage he developed more slowly than both of his brothers. By the time he was 2 years old, it was clear that something was wrong. Bernard began searching around for help, but had trouble figuring out what to do because she didn't have a roadmap for understanding what Bill's issues were. Like William Kesick, Bill Bernard was diagnosed with language disorder before his autism diagnosis. In the meantime, it was clear to his mother that Bill had more problems than just language delay. He also experienced fine motor delays, appetite problems, vision and other sensory disturbances, and an increasing loss of social connection and eye contact. It wasn't until January 1992 that Bernard first heard the word autism. She took Bill to the Cornell Medical Center in New York City, where a pediatric neurologist told her Bill's problem was largely his language disorder and a little mild autism. Looking back, this was her first indication that Bill had autism, but it wasn't until February 1993 when she took him to a psychologist who specialized in Lovas therapy that a doctor told her, without any qualification, that Bill was autistic. By then, Bill was already 5 and a half years old. For some parents, hearing an autism spectrum diagnosis applied to their child is a devastating moment. But Bernard already knew something was seriously wrong with Bill. In fact, reading the Lovas article was what had led her to the therapist in the first place, and for her, the diagnosis was liberating. An action-oriented, results-driven professional, she felt for the first time that having a concrete diagnosis, even if it was autism, could help to give her a plan and a focus. More to the point, reading the Lovas paper made her angry. Lovas argued that there was a narrow window within which to address the symptoms of autism and that the window started closing after the child reached 5 years of age. By the time Bernard read the article, Bill was already 5 and a half. If there was indeed a window for effective intervention, all the delays and misguided focus on language had left her very little time before that window would be closed for good. But anger wasn't a productive emotion. so reading the paper simply steeled her resolve to get serious. She had a lot to do, very quickly. Her first step was getting more information, so she joined every mailing list she could find, including Bernie Rimland's original organization, now the Autism Society of America, a local New Jersey group called COSAC, Center for Outreach and Services for the Autism Community, and the Greater Philadelphia Autism Society. She also signed up for the newsletter from Rimland's current organization, the Autism Research Institute, which she liked most of all because Rimland reported on science directly and had a good eye for relevant science beyond autism. Still, there was something about all these activities that frustrated her. They seemed small and grassroots-oriented, more focused on services and coping than on transformative science. Then she came across something that inspired her. At the end of 1996, she read the story of David Ho, when he was named Man of the Year by Time magazine. Ho was the scientist who had developed the cocktail of anti-HIV drugs that proved to be the first effective therapy for AIDS. If medical research can halt the AIDS epidemic in its tracks, thought Bernard, why not autism? So when some new groups with more ambition and new energy started organizing to push for more groundbreaking research, Bernard was ready for their message. One group with such larger ambitions, the National Alliance for Autism Research, NAAR, was formed in nearby Princeton. In 1995, they issued a first appeal for biomedical research in autism. That same year, on the West Coast, another group with similar aims was formed called Cure Autism Now, CAN. Soon afterward, a group of parents formed a New Jersey branch of CAN, and Bernard attended some early meetings. She liked their sense of urgency and the focus on results and signed on as a member of the local CAN chapter. Fairly quickly, the New Jersey CAN group became close. In addition to Bernard, the group included Albert Eniyati, a passionate Iranian chemist who was the chapter's founder and first president. Albert got the group involved in several meetings down in Washington, at different agencies within the National Institutes of Health. This gave Bernard an early taste of the political landscape surrounding autism. These interactions did little to tamp down her frustration, as she wasn't at all impressed by the federal government's lack of urgency. They were about as far away from a breakthrough as she could imagine. She began to wonder how she could make a difference more directly. Then, as their policy activism was increasing, the New Jersey CAN group encountered the controversy that would galvanize them. In 1997, Congress had passed the Food and Drug Modernization Act, a piece of legislation in which the FDA was directed to review the mercury content of vaccines and biologic products. Over the following months, it totaled up the mercury in three thimerosal-containing vaccines, DPT, Haemophilus influenza type B, HIB, and hepatitis B, and realized that their cumulative ethyl mercury content exceeded limits set forth by the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, for mercury exposure. Within the first 2 months of life, infants could receive 75 micrograms of mercury from vaccinations. By the time they were 2 years of age, the total exposure could come to as much as 250 micrograms. On an average basis, this cumulative mercury exposure exceeded the EPA threshold, 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per day, mcg/kg/day, for the entire first year of life. On any given day, however, the one-time or bolus exposure to mercury was nearly 90 times higher than the EPA threshold. Realizing it had a problem, on July 8, 1999, after months of internal deliberation and debate, the Public Health Service, PHS, announced a partial step. it declared its intention to phase out thimerosal from the three infant vaccines in a process that would delay, but ultimately never complete, the transition to zero exposure. Thimerosal-free vaccines were to be gradually phased into new production, though none of the details of the production transition were ever made public. None of the existing inventory would be recalled. Vaccines have shelf lives of 3 years or more, and there was a crucial loophole. Vaccines targeted for pregnant women weren't included in the thimerosal withdrawal, nor were vaccines intended for adults as well as children. And so, influenza vaccines were never affected. As public health authorities began ramping up their efforts to mandate the flu vaccine over this same period, an entirely new source of even earlier thimerosal exposure was introduced and remains to this day. In 1999, PHS announcement marked the first public notification that the childhood vaccine schedule had exceeded the limits of mercury exposure. For a while, the vaccine safety movement was slow to pick up on the issue. The autism parent community was the first to wake up. The announcement caught the attention of two parents immediately. One, a former nurse named Lynn Redwood, who was accustomed to performing weight adjustment calculations to determine the proper dose of medications, was shocked by the degree to which the recommended schedule exceeded the EPA's 0.1 mcg/kg/day guideline. The other was Albert Enayati, whose training as a chemist and Iranian upbringing had given him a greater awareness of the Iraqi grain poisoning episodes, most recently in the 1970s. Albert approached Bernard and his other friends at the New Jersey CAN chapter about the announcement. As a group, the New Jersey CAN team agreed to get to work on the issue. At first, Albert led the way, starting by collecting articles that he then circulated within the group. Bernard remembers one in particular that struck them, a case report by a medical team from St. Louis about a transplant patient. In 1996, a 44-year-old Hispanic man received a liver transplant after liver failure due to hepatitis. In the days following the operation, he received massive intravenous doses of a hepatitis B immune globulin product called HyperHep. Like the gamma globulin treatments for congenital rubella, HyperHep was preserved with thimerosal. During the course of the IV treatment, the transplant patient received more than 20,000 micrograms of ethyl mercury. The effects were immediate. Within 3 days, he began to have paranoid thoughts, lost muscle strength and his ability to walk. But most notable to the New Jersey CAN group was the effect on his speech. On post-transplant day 4, he developed difficulty in verbalizing, although he was able to write his thoughts appropriately. 9 days post-transplant, he continued to make no attempts to verbalize or phonate, although he remained fully alert. This selective loss of speech struck the New Jersey CAN group like a thunderbolt. After all, if large doses of thimerosal could selectively target speech in a grown man, what might happen if smaller doses were introduced to the brain of a developing infant? Autism parents understand regressive and selective speech problems. If thimerosal could selectively harm this man's speech, then perhaps it could help explain autism. They redoubled their research efforts. The more they learned, the more they were intrigued about the possible connection between mercury and autism. Autism obviously affected the brain, but by 1999 it was clear that autism affected other body tissues as well. Wakefield's paper had been published the year before, and it struck a chord among autism parents, many of whom had observed gastrointestinal distress in their children, but never thought to connect the dots to autism. For a number of years, Bernie Rimland's research group had been exploring the gluten-free, casein-free diet. The California report providing evidence of an exploding number of autism cases had just come out, and the Internet was growing rapidly. more and more parents were sharing medical experiences and realizing that their children had a host of immunological, gastrointestinal, and endocrine problems, diffuse and nonspecific, but pervasive. Albert wrote up a summary of what he had learned about the many symptoms of mercury poisoning and how they mirrored the symptoms being reported in autism. Bernard was impressed. By then she saw clearly what needed to be done. They would need to reach out directly to the scientific community. For a trained marketing professional like Bernard, that meant speaking in the language of the target audience, and that wasn't just a bunch of parents in a support group talking about papers. They needed to write their own paper and have it published. And in order to make it convincing, it had to be good. After all, if they had any hope of achieving the kind of breakthrough that David Ho had made in AIDS, they would have to recruit a whole new cadre of scientists to work on the problem. Resolving to get serious about publishing a paper on mercury and autism, Bernard took over Albert's working paper and began crafting a more ambitious article, one with convincing detail on the similarity in symptoms between mercury poisoning and autism. And not simply Leo Kanner's autism, but the real-world autism of the parents who lived it day to day, one that embraced Wakefield's full-body model of autism, with an autism physiology turned upside down. As she spearheaded the writing process, writing with three other parents, including Enayati and Redwood, and a researcher, Bernard also investigated the journals to which they might submit the finished draft. She realized that the New Jersey CAN team would face difficulty in finding a receptive publication. The conventional process of peer review was generally hostile to ambitious conjectures, especially those that challenged medical industry dogma. She also knew that in order to reach their intended target audience, they would need to find a journal that was both respectable — this was easy to define, the journal needed to be indexed on PubMed — and willing to take risks with new and controversial ideas. Bernard soon came across the journal Medical Hypotheses and quickly realized it was the perfect choice. She sent the editor, David Harrobin, a 100-page manuscript. He responded quickly and requested a condensed version of around 25 pages. It was April 17, 2000. Just 9 months since the PHS announcement on thimerosal. Only 3 years after the Wakefield article appeared, another front in the scientific revolution around autism was opened. Like Wakefield's paper, the article from Bernard et al. Produced strong medical industry resistance, and not just because of the content of the paper, but also because of the source. A parent had written a scientific paper. She didn't have a medical or scientific degree. She was self-motivated and self-taught, and her approach was something entirely new. Translational medicine taken to a new level of engagement. The citizen scientist. In a perfect world, one would hope that the rational process of scientific discovery would welcome and embrace the active involvement of motivated and critical consumers. A number of scientists have. Unfortunately, however, many in the medical industry would prefer that the public be left out of the messy process of setting scientific priorities, particularly when sensitive matters such as vaccination are involved. Especially in the culture of the public health profession, vaccine recipients are more generally seen as objects of instruction than informed consumers capable of making their own choices. Bernard's revolutionary act was especially unsettling for this segment. But the issue Bernard and her friends at New Jersey CAN took up was not originally discovered by the PHS in 1999. In fact, some of the medical industry, specifically a vaccine manufacturer, had discovered the problem years before. In 1991, Maurice Hilleman, a Merck scientist, had made the same calculation the FDA had performed in 1999 and reported his findings to his superiors. In a memo to the president of Merck's vaccine division, Hilleman wrote, "If 8 doses of thimerosal-containing vaccine were given in the first 6 months of life, 3 DPT, 2 Hib, and 3 hepatitis B, the 200 mcg of mercury given, say to an average of 12 pounds, would be about 87 times the Swedish daily allowance of 2.3 mcg of mercury for a baby of that size." When viewed in this way, the mercury load appears rather large. But beyond this simple arithmetic, Hilleman's memo downplayed any concern. Instead, he discussed tactics to forestall any perception problems. Following Hilleman's lead, Merck chose never to bring the issue to light, obviously not eager to remove a preservative they deemed essential for their low-cost, multi-dose vials. So, nearly 10 years later, a parent and health consumer named Sally Bernard became the lead author on the paper that confirmed Merck's worst nightmares about public perception. The product of the New Jersey CAN team's labors was formally titled Autism, a Novel Form of Mercury Poisoning, and is commonly referred to now as Bernard et al. As published in shortened form by Medical Hypotheses, the paper provided an extensive litany of symptoms of mercury poisoning, many of which we've explored earlier, paired with an equally extensive and parallel list of the symptoms of autism. And the paper concluded by using the disease archetype of acrodynia to illustrate the potential damage of low doses of mercury. Bernard et al. Sparked a flurry of scientific and media attention. Early on, Morris Karash's development partner, Eli Lilly, quietly attempted to pass legislation protecting themselves from liability for the inclusion of thimerosal in vaccines. In short order, public health authorities rushed to publish epidemiological studies exonerating thimerosal from harm. The single study from the United States was prepared by a team of CDC epidemiologists close to the vaccine program. Their initial findings, connecting thimerosal exposure to autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders, NDDs, were unpublished. After numerous modifications to the study design, these findings were reduced to insignificance and published in Pediatrics in 2003. Other epidemiological studies, which were supported by parents working in the U.S. Vaccine Court, the U.S. legal equivalent of the LAB in the United Kingdom, found evidence implicating thimerosal in autism. The Institute of Medicine convened not one, but 2 special panels to consider the thimerosal controversy. The first found reason for concern. The second effectively reversed the findings of the first. Lab work and animal models competed in similar fashion. Most notable, perhaps, were 2 studies that mimicked the effects of thimerosal exposure on developing infants. One, a mouse model developed by researchers at Columbia University, showed that thimerosal caused developmental delay in genetically susceptible mice. Another, a primate model by researchers at the University of Washington, showed that ethyl mercury remained trapped in the brain at significantly higher concentrations than other forms of mercury, including methylmercury. Before too long, the media picked up on the story. Investigative journalist and freelancer for the New York Times, David Kirby, wrote a best-selling book about the emerging thimerosal controversy, Evidence of Harm, in which he told the stories of Bernard, Lynn Redwood, Albert Eneyati, and the other mercury moms, including work from one of us. Kirby became a frequent guest of the Don Imus radio show and appeared on Meet the Press in a debate with the Institute of Medicine president, Harvey Feinberg. Environmental activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. lent his prestigious name to a blistering critique of the medical industry, Deadly Immunity, in Rolling Stone and Salon. Although Bernard succeeded beyond her expectations in raising awareness of the mercury issue by speaking directly to the scientific audience with Bernard et al., The backlash was far more intense than anything she had anticipated. To be sure, Bernard et al. Escaped the kind of direct personal assaults that had been directed at Wakefield. Nevertheless, the same kind of character assassination went on in indirect fashion. This time, as intellectual class warfare disguised as news commentary. Bernard was derided as a marketing executive, while other active parents were dismissed as desperate, emotional, and litigation-happy. Most audacious were the attempts to paint the most scientifically literate consumer activist movement in medical history as simply ignorant. The New York Times led the way in a June 25, 2005, front-page story titled On Autism's Cause, Its Parent Versus Research, reducing the parent concerns to a caricature. The medical industry was fighting back and working hard to declare the realm of science out of bounds for health consumers. The clear intention of this kind of coverage was an attempt, in David Kirby's words, to characterize parents like Bernard et al. As Bible-thumping conspiracy enthusiasts from red state redoubts, who wouldn't know scientific proof if it plopped down next to them at the tractor pull. If Bernard's ultimate goal in writing the Autism Mercury paper was to recruit scientists like David Ho to discover breakthrough autism treatments, she clearly had an uphill battle ahead of her. Paradigms Lost? Like Bernie Rimland several decades earlier, both Wakefield and Bernard provided critical challenges to orthodox autism science. For his part, Wakefield suggested that autism was not simply a genetic defect of brain tissue, but something more systemic. An insight Harvard neurologist Martha Herbert aptly summarized in a paper entitled Autism, a Brain Disorder or a Disorder That Affects the Brain. He also focused attention on the regression following vaccination. For her part, Bernard provided a different theory about vaccine exposure, one centered on the most direct way ever invented to deliver mercury to the developing brain. She was the first to advance the theory we have been developing here. Mercury exposure through medical treatment can cause widespread harm that can go undetected, and ethyl mercury exposures are implicated in the rise of autism. The Bernard and Wakefield theories are not mutually exclusive, however. In fact, as time has passed, it has become increasingly clear how, in a slightly broader theory of microbes and metals, they might be complementary. The two theories were also parsimonious. Neither offered themselves as the universal answer to all cases of autism. Wakefield simply observed a case series and suggested that the consequences of an inflamed or dysfunctional intestine may play a part in behavioral changes in some children. Bernard hypothesized a connection between mercury exposure from infant vaccines and regressive autism, a highly testable proposition. Crucially, neither theory pointed a finger at the more general expansion of the children's vaccine programs in both the United States and the United Kingdom. Faced with the dual anomalies of rising numbers and systemic disease, Wakefield's and Bernard's hypotheses were, and remain, far more plausible than the heritability model on a standalone basis. If, as Kuhn suggests, the decision to reject one paradigm is always simultaneously the decision to accept another, and the judgment leading to that decision involves the comparison of both paradigms with nature, then health consumers, in this case the autism parent community, embraced these conjectures of the new environmental paradigm in such large numbers because the conjectures matched what they were observing more closely than the orthodox model did. On the other hand, the comparison looked quite different to the medical industry. With both environmental theories placing blame in a targeted way on childhood vaccines, it was hard to imagine a challenge that was more threatening to mainstream medical science. For the medical industry, it became a choice between accepting the epidemic and defending the vaccine program, and this produced a reflexive response. and so the paradigm of genetic determinism was defended with renewed fervor. Extravagant theories arose to explain the increasing autism rates with genetic causation. Autistic men were newly fit in the Darwinian process of sexual selection because of the rise of the computer industry that gave them employment, while global mobility brought autistic couples together in a process of assortative mating that produced an epidemic of more autistic offspring. The failures of early waves of genetic studies, the HOX genes, the serotonin transporter gene, were drowned out by announcements of new waves of success in full genome scans. The hotspot on chromosome 16, the suggestive linkage on chromosome 11, the common genetic variant on chromosome 5. These were later, albeit quietly, negated when they, too, proved premature. Meanwhile, in echoes of Torrey's account of the invisible plague, talking points of better diagnosing were advanced so consistently that they became widely accepted, despite no evidence at all to back the claims. The single most prominent spokesman for the orthodox position, at least the one who has most actively sought attention, has been Paul Offit, the author of Autism's False Prophets. Coming late to his autism activism, Offit spent most of his career as an infectious disease specialist and vaccine developer, and thus probably had reason to be troubled by the intellectual challenge posed to the vaccine industry by the new environmental paradigm. He soon turned his attention to the autism problem. With little background in autism, he reached out and adopted the views of an odd segment of the autism community, the neurodiversity movement, a movement that claims that autism is ancient, that any role for the environment is impossible. That misguided attempts to treat or cure autism demonstrate intolerance toward autistic people, and that the suggestion that anyone anywhere might, however unintentionally, have done something wrong to cause autism is simply ridiculous. Offit's message has been welcomed with enthusiasm by many in the medical industry, and his personal history provides an interesting contrast. Unlike Wakefield, Offit made a large personal fortune from a group of patents he filed on a rotavirus vaccine. While he was openly working in an active commercial partnership with Merck's vaccine division, Offit sat on the Government Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, that mandated which vaccines, both categories and specific products, to include in the mandatory childhood program. Just months after his term ended, and supported by his votes establishing the rotavirus vaccine category, Merck's rotavirus vaccine product, RotaTeq, was approved for use by the FDA and ACIP and quickly reached over $500 million in sales. Offit's newfound interest in autism, in part funded by his share of Merck's vaccine profits and actively supported by media, raised the autism paradigm wars to a new level of acrimony. The debate wasn't about parents versus science, as the New York Times reported it, but rather between parents as health consumers on one side and the medical industry on the other. Both sides have been competing for the attention and resources of science, the parents armed with research and theories, but the medical industry with greater power and the clear resolve to deploy it. And yet, the initial conjectures of Wakefield and Bernard et al. Are not without problems. The biggest weakness with this first round of environmental hypotheses has been that they fail to pass some crucial tests. Any paradigm worth its salt must pass a rigorous gauntlet of challenges in order to gain scientific acceptance. Unfortunately, the strongest forms of both the MMR and thimerosal theories, the suggestion that each exposure might be both necessary and sufficient to provoke the autism epidemic, fail on a number of counts. The limits of the MMR argument have been obvious from the start. In the United Kingdom, Smith Klein Beecham's MMR formulation was introduced in 1989, just at the point when autism rates there began their sharp rise. But in the United States, pointing the finger at MMR was always far less satisfying. Merck's MMR2 was introduced in the United States in 1979, well before American autism rates began to rise. And so it was hard to argue that MMR exposures could have triggered an autism epidemic in this country. By comparison, in the United Kingdom, the limits of the thimerosal theory were similarly obvious. In the United States, the addition of two thimerosal-containing vaccines in 1990 and 1991 sharply increased mercury exposure around the time autism rates turned up. But in the United Kingdom, pointing the finger at thimerosal was also unsatisfying. The UK vaccination schedule never delivered more than 75 mcg of ethyl mercury to infants, although the timing of that 75 mcg dose changed in 1991. And so it was hard to argue that thimerosal exposures alone could have triggered an autism epidemic in that country. These limitations have been apparent to everyone on either side of the debate. The real contest has always been about the complications surrounding the natural experiments underway in both countries. And although some may have hoped that a few natural experiments would provide satisfying tests of the Wakefield and Bernard theories, nature has proven more complicated than that. These complications bring to mind a comment from the famed philosopher of science, Karl Popper, who defended the need for bold conjectures like these. Popper wrote, "He who gives up his theory too easily in the face of apparent refutations will never discover the possibilities inherent in his theory." There is room in science for debate, for attack, and therefore also for defense. But do not give up your theories too easily, not, at any rate, before you have critically examined your criticism. And there are numerous limitations to the natural experiments in both the United States and United Kingdom that make it unwise to give up the theories too easily. The schedule for the DPT shot was changed in the United Kingdom in 1990. The changes tripled ethyl mercury received by a 4-month-old baby around the same time the U.S. thimerosal exposures went up and the time U.K. autism rates rose as well. Meanwhile, in the United States, thimerosal-containing influenza vaccines were recommended and targeted at both pregnant women and 6-month-olds, just as the PHS phase-out of the other three vaccines was underway. On a weight-adjusted basis, the net recommended mercury exposure for infants remained essentially unchanged. As one exposure fell, an equivalent exposure rose in its place. In many countries around the world, but especially in the United States, the overall vaccine program continued to expand, even as thimerosal was phased out of three vaccines that remained on the schedule in reformulated fashion. In addition to influenza, new vaccines were added for rotavirus, pneumococcus, chickenpox, and hepatitis A, bringing the total U.S. childhood vaccine count to 36 doses of 14 different vaccines in 10 different products. Thimerosal was an active ingredient in the three vaccines that first used it, and probably did more than act solely as a preservative. In markets where thimerosal-free formulations of those products were introduced, new preservatives as well as immune stimulants were added. In particular, aluminum content increased in several vaccines. Background mercury exposures have risen sharply due to rising coal consumption around the world. So as mercury exposures from medicinal sources have changed, mercury exposure from manufacturing has risen sharply. For the purposes of Bernard's theory, however, one very important test was whether autism rates declined in California as the three thimerosal-containing vaccines were phased out. Unlike some CDC surveillance programs, the California autism data captured only full syndrome cases, children diagnosed with PDD autistic disorder and not PDD-NOS or Asperger's. As reported in a 2008 study, these full syndrome rates in California continued to increase without any apparent decline due to reduced thimerosal exposure. Unfortunately for those who hoped autism might be most comparable to acrodynia, reducing harmful infant exposures has appeared more difficult than banning teething powders, and rising numbers of children continue to be affected by autism. One puzzling aspect of the CDC autism tracking approach has been its inattention to critical details of autism measurement. Resolving controversies like these will require increased reporting of autism trends and greater precision in surveillance methods. To some degree, more reporting has been carried out, but unfortunately, government health authorities have made little progress in assessing the trends in the autism rate over time. In addition, they have done little to specify trends in the specific categories of varying autism severity. CDC surveillance programs have carefully excluded birth dates prior to 1990. Case counts that neglected to track case severity maximize confusion of diagnostic categorization, as Asperger's syndrome cases have been lumped into the autism totals. In both the United States and the United Kingdom, new surveillance programs that could provide crucial data on trends have been delayed for years before publication. One UK study reporting rates of 1 in 64 was first reported as an abstract in 2004 and not published until 2009. CDC surveillance sites took until 2007 to report on autism rates that were measured in 2000 and 2002. Practical surveillance issues aside, what has become increasingly clear is that epidemiology has proven a blunt instrument for resolving the debates over autism's cause. What remains logically indisputable is that any satisfying resolution requires an explanation that can account for several phenomena at once. A sharp change in disease frequency over a short period of time. Clear differences in rates across local environments, say between Oregon and Alabama, while rate increases are pervasive across national environments. A convergence of rates within national borders, alongside apparent discontinuity between different countries and regions. Unusually high rates among immigrants, such as the Minnesota Somali community, while their countrymen back home are unaffected. We've clearly observed such patterns before. These phenomena resemble the disease patterns that Emil Kraepelin saw in GPI, that Fuller-Torrey described in schizophrenia, and that John Walker Smith summarized in Crohn's disease. One thing is certain. Victory in the paradigm wars won't be won at the level of epidemiology, especially when some vaccine safety studies have been conducted so carelessly by partisans on either side of the battle. One thing on which there is agreement among the warring camps is the centrality of biology, whether it's genetics or toxicology, in getting to the real roots of the autism problem. In the realm of biology, any truly satisfying resolution requires an explanation of the neurological processes that define the disorder, and in order to get down to the neurological roots, eventually, all roads lead back to the infant brain.